it was a strange thing being hit. It didn't really hurt as such. You can't say it hurt because you're numb. And as long as I could drink tea, I was fine until I got in an ambulance and got whistled away. I was gone a couple of months and came back and asked for more. By this time, they had decided if I'm dumb enough to come and ask for more, they'll make me a sergeant. And that was it. I became a sergeant. That's not long before the end of the war. They knew the war was coming to an end. This was in 44 that I was hit in August of 44 at the Gothic Line, and in October of 44 at the...
Well, on the way to where Smokey Smith won a Victoria Cross there. Same with about 2 or 3 days later is when I got hit. Same river.
Did you look at the war differently from the standpoint of being a sergeant than as a private? There were a lot more responsibilities as a sergeant, I imagine.
To me, it was easy. It was easier because responsibility, yes. You had an easy pattern, an easy format to follow. And where there was no actual battle involved, they were very, very good to people who did not have an officer in their crew. And for a long time, I didn't have an officer. So I was treated very kindly, really, during that period. There were a couple of assaults, a couple of actions, strong actions, and on one of them, on both of them, I guess, my specific group, platoon, was not involved, was involved only in as a reserve. However, was involved as a stretcher party to carry the wounded from the actual battle line. So like I had 25, 30 men, we would go out, 5 men to a stretcher. 4 to hold, to carry, because I had to carry people a mile, sometimes a bit more than a mile, and 1 for a guard and to change over, So 5 men, 1 stretcher, 5, 6 stretchers. A lot of times I made trip after trip in the middle of a whole night long, nonstop, back and forth, back and forth. I did this a couple of times, and then eventually wound up with an officer again, so now work.
What was the problem with not having why was there no officer? Was there just a shortage?
Officers and corporals were people who got hit first because they're leaders, eh? An officer is supposed to lead his men, and he did. A corporal, it leads a section. He's number 2. So the officer is number 1, he gets it first, followed by the next guy who is going to be the leader. And so corporals and officers had a very short lifespan, it seems.
You were wounded twice as a corporal.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And it was strange that I was lucky. I would get hit. Who's lucky to get hit? You're lucky if you're still alive, so therefore you're going to get a 2-month rest. That's luck, eh?
Yeah.
And that's the way it was. When I came back, I was a sergeant, and the corporals out there. The sergeant was the pushman in a platoon, you see. The officer and the corporal were out there leading. There were 3 sections of corporals that their officer would lead, and the sergeant would always be the pushman. I was a good pushman. and my life as a fighting man ended like that, because at this time they knew the war was over in Italy, and they were sending people home who had been there 5 years, and they had a scheme called, I think, the tri-wound scheme. If you had been wounded 3 times, you went home, or if you'd been there 5 years, a couple of wounds, you went home. I came home on that system. Came home on leave and never went back, although they had options for us. You can go back if you wish, or you can stay in the service, or you can take a discharge and go out. They knew. And they were trying to get rid of people already. The war wasn't even over. And before I knew it, I was out. That's what happened. I came back here in March. I came back to Winnipeg and at the end of March of 1945. And I was out on the 4th of June, like that's today, right? On the 4th of June of 1945, I was released from the service. I joined up 8 months and 12 days later.
Tell us about that. You had a bit of a problem joining back up, didn't you?
I was switching for the CNR, and
making big dollars, like about twice as much money as my father was making, you see. My father was a man who had worked all his life. Here I was, 24 years old, making twice as much money as he was.
And quite a bit more than you were making as a sergeant.
Oh, my goodness. As a matter of fact, when I look at it now, what I was making at close to a dollar an hour, I was making plus hundreds of hours of overtime as a switchman at CNR. What I was making in 1 month was nearly the same as an entire year's salary as a private soldier at $1.30 a day. I was making close to, you know, $500, $525, $550 1 month. It was unbelievable money in 1945. I was rich. But all of a sudden I wasn't working.
What happened there?
Spare board as a spare man. All of a sudden there's no work. All the wheat is gone, all the sugar beets are gone, all this is gone in the middle of Manitoba. There's no work for a switchman from the end of December right through till April again, eh? And they told me I would have to live on working two paydays a month when all the workers would be booking out for a day off, you see. And I said, I can't live working 2 days a month, and I might have had to do that for 5, 6, 10, 15 years as a switchman before you could get a regular job. Some of those people were 20 years in there before they got a permanent job, as spare board men. I went back into the army to try and get in. They didn't want any part of me. I was a criminal, you know. I had
four pages.
I had four pages, absolutely. I was a terrible criminal. Didn't shave right. Had a whisker sticking out of my cheekbone once, and twisted shoelaces when I was a terrible person. I didn't get my hair cut 3 times a week, you know. And all this was registered as conduct to the prejudice of good order and discipline, in that I had failed to shave or failed to straighten out my shoelaces, and I was this kind of a criminal. And they were looking at these pages on both sides of my military form 6, MFM 6, and it took me 2 weeks. Every day I used to go there and talk to these people. They wouldn't talk to me. They'd send me home. I'd come back the next morning at 8 o'clock. I came back every morning. I bugged them for 2 solid weeks. Eventually, I had an interview with a board of officers, and they let me in if I signed a piece of paper saying I did not, really, I would not try to get my rank of sergeant back. I had to start back as a private, and I did. Fortunately, met one of my old commanders who... when I got back to the PPCLI, Colonel Ware, at the time, subsequently a general, recognized Carrier because I had been his signaler, his pet signaler in Sicily, And he knew I was too dumb to run away, so that he would take me there all the time with him. We'd go on some terrible flights. I mean, he scared the pants off me because this man was fearless, you know.
Let's talk about that. What was... Colonel working Ware? For him like
Colonel he was Ware a magnificent man. He was a superman, you know, because he see, you were talking about officers a little while ago, this is a man with complete and total consideration for his men, and yet he was a peacetime man, you know. Before the war he was a peacetime soldier, and he was, to me, he was a superman. He was kind, he was soft-spoken, he was completely understanding of small failings, eh? He would try to put himself, he would place himself in our place. And he would be explaining things to us. He would guide us. He was a generous person. He was a great man. And
you were saying fearless.
Absolutely. You see, there was something to do. Shells would come along. So there are shells. So what? We got work to do. We forget the shells, see? And one time in Sicily, as a matter of fact, this is an instance where we're crossing a gravel road. I'm in the ditch on one side, and he crosses the gravel road. I start to go across, and there's a terrible sound. And it's a shell coming in, and it's the last split second. And this shell passed following the road. When I was halfway across it, I dove back into the ditch I had come from, and... Major Ware at that time, he was second in command of the unit, subsequently was commander very shortly after that. And he was on the far side of the road.
shell landed between us, maybe 20 feet past, let's say, where I had been. It had gone past, and it raised a tremendous great cloud of garbage and dirt and dust, and I had fallen back in the ditch where I come from. And I was just laying there, undecided as to what I should do, numb with the sound, you know, a tremendous great roar. And the next thing I know, there he is, slapping my face, saying, "Come on, you know." And I'm numb. I don't want to get up. But 15 seconds later, I'm awake, and I'm, "Let's go, Major Ware. Let's be back in business again." I'm carrying a 36-pound radio set, mm-hmm. you see. And that's one of the reasons, I guess, I didn't want to get up. But he was a great man. See, he was concerned about me, came back across the road, picked me up, helped me. "Are you okay?" "Yes, I'm okay." "Okay, let's go. On. You ready to go?" "I'm ready to go." Away we went. He would do things with the men. As a matter of fact, it was one of his failings. As a commander, he's supposed to be in a specific place. And a lot of the time, when he was a battalion commander, they couldn't find this guy because he's sitting with the troops in the front trenches, talking to them, wanting to know how they're feeling and how life is and what can happen to make it nicer for them. He was a person concerned with individuals, and too much concern. A commander's not supposed to have that much concern, and he was. It was one of his failings. He's supposed to be sitting here pushing buttons and sending people all over the place. Instead, he would go and have a look and not get reports from other people. He'd go and get the reports himself. And sometimes they wanted him at a higher formation somewhere. Couldn't find him. He was a great man. Cameron Bethelware, C.B. Ware was his name, Cameron Bethelware. Great man. CB, confinement to barracks, it meant when he gave us the treatment.
Oh,
yeah, good initials, eh? Yeah. CB Ware. Confinement to barracks. 10 days CB, march him out. See? that would be CB Ware at his worst. He was a great, great person.
So after the war, he quickly got you promoted from private to sergeant again?
When I had been in Winnipeg for 10 days, I guess, as a private soldier, I wound up in Shiloh, where the unit was. And I arrived there on a Friday night. Saturday morning, there's an inspection. And he looks me in the eye and said, "Is that you, Carrier?" "Yes, sir, it's me." Said to the adjutant, "Get this man to the QM stores to draw 3 stripes. That was it. I was a sergeant again. That was it. I was a private soldier. I had breakfast with the privates, and I had lunch in the sergeant's mess. Okay, so I'm back in with the wheels. It was nice. And I'm sure this would not have happened if he had not been there and recognized me, remembering me from 5 years in England. I'd been in January 1940, February, March, April, after the flap, the Norway flap. Then the qualified signalers would go to various company areas where the companies were sited, and Captain Ware at the time was commanding A Company, PPCLI, and I was signaler. See, so I actually knew him, and he knew me from 1940 early, when I would be sighted in the same in his company lines as the regimental signaler with attached to that company.
Were you
see?
Attached with that company until I guess you
well,
were
I would,
promoted?
Well, we would
or?
Be moved around, you know, but I did work for him for any number of months. And then as a headquarters man running exchanges and switchboards and offices in the headquarters company area, where he became the commander of the headquarters company. So I saw him lots of times because they would march me to him, and I would have to explain how dumb I was to him. Yet he would say, "You'll have to, you know, shape up here and get more haircuts and do this and whatever." Hey, I used to beat 1 charge out of 2 for all these terrible splotches on my crime sheet. I had been found innocent on any number of others. But he was a kind person, this guy. Great man. I'd known him all my life in the service, and subsequently as a brigadier and as a general. And to this day, when I meet him, I meet a great man. Lives in Qualicum right now.
Okay, let's talk about what life was like in the post-war period in the PPCLI.
initially it was all partying, eh? We were receiving our gratuities and rehabs, rehab credits, and buying things, furniture. Those who were a lot of young people getting married, trying to organize to live on the money we were making. Soldier was never rich.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, exercises, training, and with a good social life now, even for the young people, for the private soldiers and the corporals. They had their own clubs, and the sergeant's messes are famous for hundreds of years as being the, you know, a social area that is unbelievable. See, you didn't need any money. We never had any money, but we didn't need any money to have a real good time, organized functions of parties, dances. Life was good. Was good and exciting, because always different things to do. Subsequently went airborne. That was quite early too, 1947-48. PPCLI became the first parachute unit in Canada after they had disbanded. After the war, they had disbanded the Canadian Parachute Regiment, and we started again, all volunteers, of course, say, eh? Like anyone who doesn't want to volunteer, take a pace forward. You've got to be a brave man. Of course, we were all volunteers. And
what was that like, the change to airborne?
Oh, that was very exciting. And and of course, the dress. We wanted red berets and mm-hmm. red jump boots. Eh? Yeah. Only officers could wear brown boots, but now jumpers wore brown boots. And everyone wanted to have officer boots. And of course, the red beret. And a set of wings, a tremendous mark of distinction, mm-hmm. eh? And we were all very proud of this, and in due course I had my share. I'm scared of height. If I'm 10 feet up a ladder, I cling for dear life, you know?
What was it like jumping out of a plane?
Strange, totally different, because, you see, to this day I've tried to get someone to explain this to me, and no one has ever. Listen to what I'm going to tell you. There's a dimension missing somewhere when you're at altitude. Not height, but altitude. There's a dimension missing which no one has been able to explain to me. Why it is that when you're 1,000 feet high, a house is only this big, you know, about an inch and a half, 2 inches big. A horse looks the size of an ant. That's 1,000 feet. That same horse, if you put that same horse 1,000 feet away at the end of a rifle, let's say it's a target horse, eh, I could take the eye out of that horse just about, because that was a pretty fair shot. That's 335 yards, right? 1,000 feet, 333 yards. And that is an easy rifle shot for a good shot. But from an airplane or to an airplane, 1,000 feet high, it's a totally different situation, because of this particular dimension that is missing. And for that reason, when you're way up high, it's not height anymore. There's something missing. So it's not tough to walk out of the door of an airplane. That's the easy part. Landing is the tough part, because you can break your neck, your legs, and whatever, unless you follow a very strict format for landing, you know, where you use bones as well as muscles, you know, to take up the shock and of hitting the ground at a specific speed, because although they had decided that 15 mile an hour wind was the strongest wind that would be used for jumping, it certainly was for learning to jump. But subsequently, as a trained paratrooper, if they said they were jumping, sometimes the wind might have been 20-25, I don't know how much speed. And you jumped, that was it. And you would land and bounce 7 times, it seems, you know, rolling, and you weren't hurt if you knew exactly what to do. I jumped in the water twice with life-saving equipment in the water. I jumped in the water 30 miles an hour one time, but a splash, zap, you know, and you can't hurt yourself hitting water 30 miles an hour. So it was easy. It was nice. I enjoyed jumping. And I was warrant officer of the Airborne School in Rivers for 3 years, Rivers, Manitoba, when the school was there before it was moved, to Petawawa, Edmonton, Petawawa. And it was good. I enjoyed it. That wasn't great for career, as far as career was concerned. But for excitement and fun, it was great. And they wanted a bilingual officer, or warrant officer at the school. And a Westerner, a PPCLI one, I was the only one. They weren't great on, you know, there weren't too many bilingual types initially in the PPCLI. Subsequently, they did get some. But initially, there were very, very few French-speaking people in the PPCLI. Good outfit, good unit. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move on with your career. What were you doing between the end of the war and say Korea?
The airborne situation
yeah.
took place, shortly after we reorganized in Calgary, I went out on training with the reserves, A&T staff it was called, administration and training, and spent nearly 3 years with them. So I was gone from the unit then, but I came back when Korea started and stayed with one battalion, PPCLI. They were forming other units by this time. Second battalion was formed and went directly to Korea, where they won a presidential, United States presidential citation. The only Canadian troops, the only troops, as a matter of fact, to have this in the Canadian forces. United States presidential citation.
Right.
They wear like a medal form item on their shoulders, you know, little patch on the shoulder. And for some heroics in Korea, the history is well known, took place in April of 1950, when the unit was surrounded and fought and was delivered, ammunition and food was delivered to them by air, and they held a line, and they held things until people regrouped and came back and reformed the line again. They were isolated and on their own. They could have been wiped out, I guess. That was a good action, a good battle action. We never saw that. My unit didn't see that, 1st Battalion, because we replaced them after they had been there a year. Prior to that, there was the normal training and exercise, you know.
Okay, let's talk about career. What was your rank and function in?
I was a supply sergeant, a staff sergeant, my job was to make sure that the troops had food, ammunition, and the supplies of clothing and things that they were required to have, that they needed, let's say, when it was cold in the winter, because we arrived there in October, November, and to replace the other unit, and we stayed there until October, November, a year later. November the 11th, we left the lines in Korea, as a matter of fact. So the thing was that my job was supplies, and we were by this time in a static area, because the big balloon was up for where they were negotiating, where peace negotiations were going on. And that was not very far from where we were. We were in North Korea at this time, because the line, if you know your line, was diagonally across the north section, about a third of the way from the west coast of Korea up. And then where we were, central Korea, we were more than 20, 25 miles deep into North Korea at this time. And the line angled further north and east, you see, from the 30th parallel. Eh? And we just stayed there static. So after a while, when the positions were good and safe, let's say, when there was not, some areas were more, there was more noise and more patrolling and more, and there was always patrolling and nuisance raids of sorts, you know. Where it was really safe, I used to take food to these people at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Breakfast, you were saying.
Breakfast mm-hmm. at 6 in the morning in great containers, you know, where the eggs were hot and the bacon was hot and the toast was a little soggy maybe. but I would have bearers, Koreans, who would carry these monstrously heavy items, you know, because they were actually they were made to hold heat, to preserve heat, and they were very heavy and well insulated units, you know. And
these right to the front.
We'd march up the hills, and people would come out in blobs of 10, 15 at a time and grab breakfast and run back to their pits. Another blob would come in.
the whole unit would have breakfast.
You called yourself an accidental officer at this time. What did you mean by that?
Well, in due course, I became a warrant officer in Korea, and I stayed a warrant officer for 14 years. I was a warrant officer class 2, company sergeant major, and eventually a warrant officer class 1. And accidental officer, well, I was commissioned from the ranks because I feel they had a need for officers. The officer group was disappearing. They were paying them so poorly at this time. It was a matter to me of economics because they didn't have the officer material to send them on the various minor jobs that they needed to, that they normally would have gone through as experience to reach higher rank. What happened was the young officers would quit. They didn't get paid.
They could
receive twice as much money or more for their degree they had in industry, business, or commerce, or whatever, in Civvy Street. They if they had gone through our military colleges, would serve the time that they had to serve under contract. Okay?
Right.
They had to serve 3 years.
3 years.
They would finish their serving time and get out. And it was sad. They were excellent men, really super soldiers, because I spent 6 years as a warrant officer at the School of Infantry in Camp Borden, and part of my job on a yearly basis for a specific period of time was training these people. Was part of, let's say, they had a platoon of officer cadets who were out of Royal Roads, out of Collège Militaire Royal de Saint-Jean, out of Kingston, out of Royal Military College. I know what they were like. They were sharp, eh? These people were ahead of you all the time, you know, eh? They were like sponges, the way they absorbed all kinds of knowledge. We thought we were wizards. In 2 weeks, they knew everything we knew. So we're not great wizards, really, but I helped train some of these people who are generals today, eh? Oh, it's great when you look back. I can remember this dumb cadet today is a top general in the Canadian Forces. He was... Well, this one, he was not a dumb cadet, I'll tell you. De Chastelain, specifically, I'm thinking about. John de Chastelain, a super soldier. This guy could resist all the little things that men failed of, you know? Like he could stay awake 10 days without sleeping, I'll swear. Whenever all the other cadets were dead, John de Chastelain still did a diary of everything that had happened. You see, he was a superman, eh? And he was quiet, never said very much, was always top-notch. He was always a top gun. He was always there. And today he's a lieutenant general. I can remember him as a cadet in 1958. A cadet. Hey, when I saluted cadets. They wore one pip on a little white cloth, you know, eh? When I saluted that cadet, I knew I was saluting a general. There's no good. He got my best. He got a dandy every time. He's a good man. And any number of others. Foster, Kent Foster, is a general today. And half a dozen others are brigadier generals. They were excellent men. Top-notchers, you know. And they stayed. They got paid, eh? $400 a month they got paid. $400 a month. It was terrible. Anyhow, one day they had no officers. They went looking in the ranks for officers. They took old dogs like myself who had been loyal to the system for all the years. And even though we didn't have the education, they had a format for bringing out our value, if there was any. Or if there was not, and the format would come out with that. And they gave us a test, an equivalency rating test based on all subjects except math and science. And if you were a person who had was curious about life outside of the service, if you were a person who was well up on current events and affairs in the world, if you had an idea about where certain locations in the world were, if you had read lots of books, and I read millions of books, it seems, and you had to have a general knowledge, background knowledge, about a dozen and 101 different things. And if they could extract this information from you, you were considered to have reached a specific academic level that was acceptable to be to them, and they made you an officer. It was called Classified A or B, a commission, classified commission, A or B. A was from a W01 to a captain. B was from a W02 to a lieutenant for 3 years, automatic captain after that. And that was it. And I got one of those. I was a one, so one day I was a one, next day I was a captain. Yeah, that was it.
How was your pay as a captain from a W01?
It was not very great, because I held the pay of a warrant officer class one, or chief warrant officer today it's called, for 5 years, because there's a rule that says you cannot be promoted and get less money. And under vested rights of pay, I kept the pay of a warrant officer class one for 5 years. Mm-hmm. With the increments that a warrant officer class one was receiving, and with the increments that a captain was receiving, though they were 4 or 5 times higher as a captain, it took 5 years for these to level out, until one day, when I had been in the rank of captain for 5 years, one day I was making gravy. It was $13 a month more than a warrant officer class one. Uh-huh. I immediately rushed to the pay office and had my pay changed to the pay of a captain, because hey, that was big money, $13 a month. That was it. So, it took 5 years. I was a captain for 8.5 years, I guess, before, and finished my time with 35 years, 1975.
1975?
Yeah.
Do you have any reflections on your long career in the military?
Oh, to me, it was a good life, because, perhaps it cannot just be because it treated me well in due course. And, I mean, after I gave up fighting, I wasn't very good fighting. I lost my first 11 fights in a row, like I said.
Yeah.
I was always honest with it. I was honest with time, and they knew they could get all kinds of mileage out of me because I believed in the system, and as such, they could get any amount of work from me that they wanted. I worked 100-hour weeks a lot of time. There was no overtime pay for these things. I enjoyed it. I liked it. I liked people, you see. And as a warrant officer, people were my specialty, eh? They were good people. There were rotten people. There were people in between. There were drunks. There were shirkers. There were good workers. There were good men. Met all kinds, and I liked people. I used humor in large measure to communicate with these people. If that didn't work, then they found out what a rotten sergeant major I could be. It was as simple as that, eh? But that was not the way I started. I would try to use humor, and it worked for me. It worked well for me. Because they would soon find out that unless they humored me, and then things would get tough. No, unless things worked well, they had to work well. And I extracted any amount of work from my men. You say, you know, a sergeant major say that's his company, although it belongs to the major, the captain, the lieutenant. From my men, I extracted any amount of good work by using humor and by mixing with them. And I did. I enjoyed it. It was good. At the end of it was nice, because as an officer, I had to lose some of those bad habits that a warrant officer develops, because all of a sudden you think you can do no wrong. Well, you can do wrong. You can make mistakes as a warrant officer just as well. But in 14 years as a warrant officer, when you are the supreme power, you know, as far as discipline is concerned, of 130, 40 men as a company, and nearly 1,000 in the infantry as a one, hey, as a warrant one, tremendous power. All of a sudden, as an officer, as a captain, this power was reduced by 900% minimum, you know, and I developed better habits, normal sort of habits, let's say. Now you could sit there, and you had a staff, a small staff. I had one officer and a sergeant and two corporals working for me when I was a recruiting officer, for instance, and that was nice. I was a recruiting officer in Victoria for 3.5 years, for Vancouver Island, north, all over the place, and it was a super job. I enjoyed it because it meant meeting a lot of people. I went to the schools and gave talks on the what was happening in the service.
Is this right at the end of your career?
This was, yeah, near the end, yeah. That's
so
right.
It was a plan to retire in Victoria,
oh,
was it?
Oh, it was never planned that way. No, because I can remember negotiating when I was in Quebec. I spent 3 years in Quebec as an officer, working on high staff, instructional staff with the reserves, and I wanted out of there in the worst way because an Anglo-Saxon regiment person in Quebec was not the most popular things during the days when there was a high feeling about separatism, and there was, and I didn't encourage any of this because I was trying to show these people that it was easy to be a Canadian, you know. They didn't believe that. They said I had been absorbed in this Anglo-Saxon movement and I was a renegade type, and they were not going to take any of that. I wanted home. Home was where my father and mother are buried on a hill in Westminster. And eventually they sent me here and to Vancouver as a recruiting. And there was a need for a person to come over here to Victoria. I volunteered for this and got it. And life was really nice. It was really pleasant to me. So that was it. 35 years was a good life. I was scared by experts during this life, by absolute experts, really, some really tough and mean types. And I also met and worked for some excellent and dedicated and fine people, warm human beings who made life beautiful for me and all the people around me, for soldiers. And to this day, I think back on this a lot of times with good feelings. Life was good.
You wouldn't have changed anything?
No, sir. No. It was great.